good evening, and thank you for coming to our program, Cosmetic Surgery and Permanent Makeup. This is part of a series of programs on medical halacha and medical ethics shared between Shari Shamayim and the Bayit up in Thornhill. This is, I think, our second one this academic year at Shari Shamayim. We had one in November on minors in medicine. We have a couple of more coming up this year. One is on dental emergencies on Shabbat, and then another one is on treating terrorists. So those are the remaining two for the year here. The ones that remain up at the Bayit are stress in Jewish law and choosing how does a rabbi choose a doctor? No, the other way around. How does a doctor choose? That would be good also. But, how does a doctor choose a rabbi? We're close. Both good questions. I want to thank Shari Shamayim for once again being very accommodating, and they even set up a projector and a screen that I'm not using. Well, the projector's coming in handy to support the camera. So I appreciate that. Also, as always, the indefatigable Jeffrey Lipsitz with his indefatigable emails. Is it pronounced that way? No, indefatigable, right? Yeah, I thought so. Okay. Either way, he doesn't get tired. So thank you very much, Jeffrey, for everything. I mentioned that the sign-in sheets are circulating. Please make sure that you do sign in. It's useful for a few things. One is that if you want to get CME credit, we have to know you were here. So you do need to sign in on the sheet for that purpose. Even if you're not looking for CME credit, if you sign in, you'll get notification about other medical halacha, medical ethics classes. Also, you'll get follow-up from this one. In the event that questions are asked and I need to do research to find an answer, I tend to follow up by email with those who signed in. If you don't sign in, you won't get the email. That's guaranteed. If you could, please do. Your email address is not shared. If you have a cell phone with you and you'd be able to put it on mute or vibrate, I'd appreciate it. The topics that we're going to discuss are practical topics. These are issues that people come across in a day-to-day life. You see the heading, cosmetic surgery, permanent makeup. These are issues that do come up. Nonetheless, nothing that I say takes the place of the halachic guidance of your rabbi. What I'm going to be doing is discussing issues and presenting ideas, but ultimately I'm a very strong believer in the idea that your rabbi should be the one who you go to for practical guidance. So we begin with an introductory note that is sort of a necessary first step in talking about cosmetic surgery. And that's the issue of elective surgery altogether. Now, not all cosmetic surgery is elective surgery necessarily, but what I'm talking about when I say cosmetic surgery is not really the reconstructive surgery, the burn victim. I'm not dealing with those cases. Rather, I'm dealing with what we think of as elective surgery. A person says, I feel like the reason I'm having a hard time getting married is because of the configuration of my nose, or you know, a man or a woman feels like they're in need of liposuction. I'm trying to distinguish between cases in which there is a threat to one's physical health and the rest of the reasons why a person might opt for cosmetic surgery. I deliberately did not put vignettes on the page because I didn't want to get into trouble. But that's the type of case I'm talking about, and I'm assuming it is indeed elective. And so we have to start out with the question of whether elective surgery is at all okay within Jewish ethics, within Jewish law. Why might it not be okay? What would be a concern in elective surgery in general, cosmetic or otherwise? Yes? Person is entering into a position of risk. All surgeries involve risk. Yes? Harry, you were going to say? Okay. Yeah? Right. one is not allowed to injure oneself. You can't wound yourself, and surgery involves a wound. Good. Other considerations? Yes. Well, that it's not, and but therefore what? There are many things I do that are not for saving my life. Right, that the license to practice medicine is potentially just where it is a healing act, as opposed to non-healing acts. Good. So first, let's talk about this issue of endangering oneself. I brought you one source, source number one, Dr. Arthur W. Perry, Straight Talk About Cosmetic Surgery. He had good statistics, so that's why I picked him. There are many things you can find online about the risks of elective surgery in general, cosmetic surgery particularly. And he writes, the risk of dying in any surgical procedure is between 1 in 250,000 and 1 in 500,000. And this is 2007 that he writes this. This is similar to the risk of dying in a plane crash. In contrast, the chance of being involved in a fatal car accident was estimated at 1 in 2,000 in a study of the California highway system. I can't believe that number is true. With the number of people who are on the road, I mean, that's a... I don't understand that number. I don't know what that number means. But that's what he has here. And 1 in 5,000 nationwide, again, there's something wrong with that number. Nonetheless, sorry, you think it's true?
Yeah, depends on how you calculate.
Well, that's what I'm asking. In other words, if on any given day in California you have a million people on the road, does that mean that 50,000 of them are going to be in a fatal car accident?
No.
I hope not.
Over
5,000.
10 or 12 years.
500. Well, that's the question. It's lifetime risk, right? Okay. Right. Correct. But I think that he could use more details there. In any case, I mean, the equivalent really to make it fair, so to speak, what he would have to do is compare the risk to someone who drove on the roads every day for life and the risk to someone who had plastic surgery every day for life. That would be a more accurate comparison. In any case, certain procedures are more risky than others. This is the part that really matters. Certainly, the risk of death during eyelid surgery is much lower than the 1 in 50,000 risk of dying during liposuction. In a study of 23 office surgery deaths in Florida between January 2000 and May 2004, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons found that the death rate was about 1 in 16,000 procedures overall. An interesting statistic emerges when this information is critically analyzed. The death rate for non-board certified plastic surgeons and other doctors such as dermatologists was 1 in about 11,000 procedures. The death rate was 3 times lower, about 1 in 35,000, in patients operated on by board certified plastic surgeons. However you slice the numbers... Sorry, that wasn't on purpose. However you look at the numbers, the bottom line is there is indeed risk involved. All surgeries involve risk, whether we're talking about risk of infection, whether we're talking about anesthesia, whether we're talking about something from the act of surgery itself, and the specifics of cosmetic surgery here. And the Torah says numerous times, in numerous ways, that we are instructed to protect our lives. One example, Minishmartem Ma'od L'Nafshotechem, we are told that we are obligated to guard our lives. However, we can't seriously entertain the idea that the Torah instructs us never to engage in risky behavior. How do you know that? Sorry? Well, bris milah would be a different case because that's a mitzvah. In other words, I'm obligated to do it. But how do I know that I'm allowed to engage in optional risky behavior?
War.
Going to war? And you could argue self-defense. The fact that you're here tonight. You got in your car. You went out on the road at night, right, where there is ice in places. It's not as bad as they predicted it would be. But fundamentally, you took a level of risk, right? I mean, we did. We're here, thank God. The reality is that we engage in risky behavior of one kind or another all the time. You go on a ride in an amusement park, right? Every once in a while, we see headlines about what happens on rides at amusement parks. And yet, we go on rides at amusement parks. People engage in all sorts of of endeavors as a means of making a living. Some trades are riskier than others. I don't know of a rabbi who will prohibit people from becoming construction workers, even though there are absolutely risks in becoming a construction worker. There are risks in becoming a psychologist. There are risks in becoming a rabbi. There are risks in a variety of fields, and yet we do this. This is perhaps best summed up by source number two. Source number two speaks of a biblical verse, which you can see the reference there, is talking about not delaying someone's wages. There's a biblical law that says that if somebody works for me and they finish their job or they finish the period of time after which they're supposed to be paid, I am supposed to pay them immediately. And there are actually several prohibitions against delaying payment. And when the Torah lays this out, it says, "Ve'elav hu nosei et nafsho," for this, meaning for the salary, he puts his life on the line. The person who works for you puts his life on the line in order to earn those wages. So on this, the Talmud comments, why did this person climb the ramp, become suspended from the tree, give his life over to death? Why did he do whatever it was that needed to be done, climbing the ramp perhaps and building a brick wall, climb a tree in order to harvest fruit? Why did he endanger himself? Lo al schara, was it not for his wages? And the Talmud isn't discussing a question of, are you allowed to risk your life or not? What the Talmud is trying to say here is simply that it is recognized that people endanger themselves in order to make a living, and there is not a whisper of, hey, you're not allowed to do that. It's understood that this is normal behavior. Now, there are boundaries for this. Even though I just said that you're allowed to become a construction worker, the truth of the matter is that there are limits to what is considered to be acceptable risk. And from the standpoint of Jewish law, generally speaking, the standard is what people will normally tolerate. In other words, if you were to poll a group of people within society, Jews, non-Jews, doesn't make a difference, but if you were to take a poll of the public, would they consider this to be an acceptable risk for the benefit? So, bungee jumping. You have to ask people, would you consider bungee jumping to be an acceptable risk? Riding a roller coaster, would you consider that to be an acceptable risk? Driving in a snowstorm, would you consider that to be an acceptable risk? If the response from the majority of people is, yeah, this is what we do, then the response is, that's okay. That's considered to be something that is acceptable to do. And we'll see examples of this in a moment. But take a look at source number three, where Rabbi J. David Bleich brings this into context in terms of dangerous medical treatments. And he writes, although every therapy is fraught with danger, the hazards of treatment are specifically sanctioned when incurred in conjunction with a therapeutic protocol. Accordingly, the practice of the healing arts may be permitted, even if designed simply for the alleviation of pain. He's not talking about cosmetic surgery in this context. What he's saying is, people undergo medical treatments that involve a level of risk, and when the Torah says, "Virapo yirape," that doctors are in fact allowed to practice medicine, even encouraged to practice medicine in order to help people, it's understood there's always going to be risk involved. There is no such thing as a treatment that comes without risk and without side effects. Nonetheless, that's considered to be acceptable. It comes up in the context of elective surgeries in source number four. Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, author of Responsa Chelkat Yaakov, you can see there, I try to give the reference for where the person lived and when. So 20th century, he was Switzerland after the war. I don't remember where he was born, but Switzerland was post-World War II. But he talks about the fact that women are allowed to become pregnant. Now, I mean, that's not news. We're all here. But he says, you know, isn't pregnancy dangerous? Isn't giving birth dangerous? And certainly in earlier times, the mortality rates, thank God, more dangerous than it is today, that we've managed somewhat with that. But take a look at source number four. He says, look, Mavor b'Shabbos Lamed Beis Yoledes b'Chezka Sakana. He says it's clear, Shabbat 32, that's the reference in the Talmud, that a woman is in danger when giving birth. Could one entertain the thought that a woman could not marry and give birth because she thereby endangers herself? That's the way of the world, he says. And since the public does it, he quotes a verse from Psalms, Shomer Psayim Hashem, God guards the fools. We may all be foolish for entering into certain risks, but everybody does it, and that's the way it is. We have found this stated frequently in the Talmud regarding danger, quote, since many people trample on it, God guards the fools. And he then applies that to elective surgery. And he says so too here, since the masses trample on it, going to doctors, even though surgery is dangerous, God guards the fools. Our eyes see, thank God, that the great majority of patients for whom this surgery is done, God save us, are healed. So that's his statement regarding elective surgery and the risks that are involved. Now, it's worth noting that this is not necessarily universal license for elective surgery. The assumption is that your benefit outweighs whatever the risk is that's involved. The assumption is that there is something to be gained that is so great that you're justified in entering into whatever the risk is. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, source number 5, says, not so fast. Now, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg certainly knew from surgery. He was the Rabbi for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel for decades, until his passing about 12 or 13 years ago. And he was against, in general, he was against elective cosmetic surgery. Because he felt that beauty is insufficient as something, as a goal to justify the risk. If you take a look at source number 5, he says, he said, it is clear that one can only permit the novelty which is directly taught, meaning that when we say you're allowed to enter into risks in order to be healed, it's specifically in order to be healed, and we're not going to expand beyond that, he says. To heal and restore the loss of one's body. This excludes wounding for the sake of beauty, which does not restore the loss of the body, but only wounds it to alter it as one wishes, and to be clever regarding the form engraved by its creator, or to renew its youth and contradict the decree of the monarch of the world. Presumably he means aging. How much more so is it beyond doubt that one certainly may not introduce himself into any danger for this? He says beauty doesn't justify it. That's his argument in response. So the upshot of what we're saying, by the way, I brought you the Hebrew because I wanted to be there so that those who know the Hebrew are able to read it, but in the interest of time, I'm going to end up reading mostly the English out loud. But the upshot of what we've said to this point is that yes, one is allowed to enter into risk in order to achieve a gain. There is risk with all elective surgery. However, if it's something that people normally are willing to risk, so good, you're able to risk it. With Rabbi Waldenberg's caveat, he believes that that's only if you have a certain level of benefit that's to be gained, and he believes that cosmetic surgery would not justify it. We're going to come back to beauty as a justification in a bit. So, well, we'll have to see more about that. But let's say you had somebody who had the opportunity to have such a surgery, but it wasn't going to be done with what Arthur Perry in source number 1 talked about as a board-certified plastic surgeon. Someone says, listen, I have a friend who's having a Botox party. According to what we've said, is that a good idea or a bad idea? Right? According to what we've said, that would seem to be a bad idea. Even if you believe that the treatment is okay and that the treatment is justified, ultimately, you'd have a responsibility to minimize the risk involved and to go to the board-certified surgeon as opposed to somebody in someone's apartment. I know nothing about Botox, so that's really the extent of what I got. Yes? Right, so the answer is yes and no. You're right that Botox, technically, you'd look at it and say, well, is that really a surgery? I'm using the term more as procedure than surgery in that context, because the fundamental question of, am I allowed to undergo a treatment that I didn't need, which involves some risk, will apply to surgery and will apply to procedures, and yes, will apply to procedures that aren't about beauty at all, you know, such as the cortisone shot. The question fundamentally will always apply. And it'll apply when I go to the doctor and the doctor prescribes any treatment and says to me, well, you know, this could damage your liver. So I have to ask, there's a level of risk involved. Where does that fall out on the curve of what people in general are willing to accept? And how does it relate to the potential benefit? Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely true. All of these are. It's really not limited to surgery. The concern for risk to oneself is not about surgery. It's about any endeavor into which one enters, which involves some level of risk. Now let's talk about something that is surgery specific, though. And that's the second point that we identified. And that's the issue of wounding oneself. The Talmud states very clearly, I brought it for you in source number 6, the Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. There's a debate in the Talmud about whether one is allowed to harm himself or not. And the Talmud here in this source in particular links it to the story of the Nazir. Remember that the Nazir is somebody who takes a vow not to do several things, one of which is not to drink wine. And as part of this concern, as part of the ritual of the Nazir, after completing the period of being a Nazir, the Nazir has to bring an offering. Several offerings, actually. One of them is called in Hebrew a chatat. What is a chatat? Anybody know? A sin offering. Right. It's an offering of atonement for having sinned. So the question is, how has he sinned? The person took a vow. They fulfilled the vow. That's it. Where is the transgression? So on a literal level, the answer is there is no transgression. There's a class of offerings that are called chatat, which generally are for sin, but sometimes they're brought for other purposes, as in the case of the Nazir. However, the Talmud adds a note in this regard, and that's what you see in source number 6, suggesting that the sin that the Nazirite, the Nazir, has committed is by abstaining from wine, because he caused himself pain. I'm not talking now about somebody who has an alcoholic issue and should be staying away from wine. That's not what we're dealing with. What we're saying is somebody with the option of engaging in pleasure and opted to abstain from it is actually paining himself. And what we're saying is you're not supposed to pain yourself even voluntarily. And so the Talmud in fact does state, and this is ruled as a matter of law, that one is not allowed to wound oneself. Even if you want to, even if this is your goal, nonetheless, not allowed to wound oneself. So, does that then mean I'm not allowed to turn to a surgeon and say, cut me, for the sake of something other than preserving my health, for the sake of, you know, this elective surgery that I don't really need? Maybe I shouldn't be allowed to go to the surgeon and say, operate on me. What might be the answer to that? Yeah? Good. We're going to come to the mental health question. We're not there quite yet. Yes? Right. What if overall it's therapeutic? And whether that's therapeutic because of mental health considerations or others, we're going to come to. But the question is, what if it's, maybe it is indeed therapeutic? And I give you an example in source number 7. The Talmud asks a very interesting question. There is a harsh prohibition that forbids a child from wounding the child's parent. Child is not allowed to wound the parent. What if the child is a surgeon and the parent needs surgery? Is the child allowed to operate on the parent? And it doesn't have to be major surgery. It can be plucking a thorn out of their skin and potentially causing them to bleed. Or it can be amputation. Is the child allowed to operate knowing that this is meant to be therapeutic? And if you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Rama, writing in the Ashkenazi part of the Shulchan Aruch of the Code of Jewish Law, says, "In ein sham acher lasos," if there's no one else around who can do it, "v'hu mitztayer," and the father is in pain, "harehu makizo v'choteichlo k'fi ma sheyershuhu lasos." The son should let his blood, bloodletting having been a quite popular treatment over the centuries, the son should let his blood, the son should cut, whatever it is, as long as this is the only option. If we have an option of asking somebody else to do it, yes, we should ask somebody else to do it. We had a class last year, the year before, about taking care of elderly parents, and what if the parent says, "I specifically want my child because my child is the one I trust." That was its own discussion back then. And I'm not going to reopen that right now, but the point that emerges from here is, even in the case where it involves wounding a parent, which carries an extra layer of prohibition, nonetheless, we do say that you are, in fact, allowed to do it? How much more so if we're not talking about parent and child, but we're talking about people in general? If it is therapeutic, it is indeed permitted. Why is that permitted? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein explains in source number 8, he's dealing with cosmetic surgery, that if you look at Maimonides and his description of the prohibition against wounding somebody else, Maimonides writes something which adds an element of motivation. He says, if you hit somebody, bederech, and there are two different editions in Maimonides, either bederech nitzayon or bederech bizayon. What is bizayon?
Embarrassment.
Embarrassment, disgrace. Nitzayon is harder. Good. Victory. They, if a person wounds somebody else, either as an act of embarrassing them, showing them I am stronger, or as an act of victory, meaning I beat him up and I got something as a result, in either of those cases, you violated the prohibition against wounding somebody. But in the case of surgery, where they came to you and asked you, would you please do this, that fits neither description. It's not for the sake of embarrassing the person. It's not for the sake of beating the other person up. And therefore, Rabbi Feinstein, in source number 8, he's dealing with the question of a woman who wants to undergo a nose surgery because she feels that she's not able to get married because of the way her nose looks. Leave aside the counseling issues of this. We can come back to that later. But the question that's put to him is this legal? Is this allowed within Jewish law? And his answer is yes. His answer is, this is not done to harm, this is done to help. The prohibition against surgery is not applicable. So it's not clear how far he'll go with this in terms of justifying this for benefit, but it's clear in this case, at any rate, he says it will be permitted. So the upshot of the past 20 minutes or so is that, number one, if you want to engage in an elective surgery, the first question you have to ask is this a risk which people normally take? Number two, and again, people doesn't mean a particular subclass. It isn't, Ashkenazi Jews who live at Bathurst Lawrence. It's the general population in the area. That's number one. Number two is this an act of healing such that the wounding would be justified? Those are the two requirements in general for elective surgery. Yes?
This criteria doesn't strike me as that valid. Tons of people smoke, and I don't think the Torah would say that that's justified just because so many people do.
Right. So I want to make 2 points on that. It's a very important point. In the smoking case is the perfect example. Number one is that decades of responsa took exactly that approach. Decades of responsa on the issue of smoking after they had already started to come out with evidence that it was so harmful. Decades of responsa said, yeah, but people do it. And therefore, Shomer Psayim Hashem, God guards those who are foolish. No, they shouldn't be doing it, but I can't prohibit it because this is a normal behavior. So that's, you should realize, that which you posed as a, could this be true? Actually, yes, it was said. And it is still said by some. I shouldn't put it entirely in the past tense. But number two, what you are posing is the Empire State Building question, or at least, I grew up in New York, maybe here at the CN Tower question, right? When the child comes home from school and says, I want to do X, right? And the parent thinks it's a really bad idea and says, I want to do X and everybody in my class is doing it, right? Well, if everybody in your class was jumping off the Empire State Building, would you do that too? In other words, do we say that just because everybody would do it, therefore it's licensed? Or is there such a thing as a threshold of harm or a threshold of risk at which we say it doesn't matter what everybody else is doing? Logically, from a common sense perspective, there does have to be a limit, as you're suggesting. A point at which you say it doesn't matter how many people are doing it, you're still not allowed to do it. But I don't know what that threshold is. I don't know how to draw the percentages. It's a good question. Yes?
The question of everybody, you group us, you said it, the entire world. We are a very special group of Jews. Do we not have a higher responsibility? Do we not answer to a higher moral authority than the average or the majority?
So So the question that was asked was, should we be grouped separately? Should Jews, in fact, since we have our own calculations and our own instructions and our own Torah, should we in fact have our own calculation? Oh, thank you. And the answer is, it's an interesting perspective, but I don't think so. I think that the definition of normal for these purposes, in fact, is social in general. The question of why not go with Jews specifically, I think, has to do with defining normal risk based on the pool of people who, if they would engage in this activity, would be in danger, which isn't just Jewish, it's everybody. So I suspect that that's why. Okay.
70% of those under the age of 35 engage in body enhancement.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, but this is only in terms of calculating risk. It's not in terms of whether I now have to engage in every behavior that you know most people do. It's only a question of, is this considered to be risky such that I shouldn't engage in it? That I don't have to, if everybody out there wears white shirts, I don't have to wear a white shirt because they wear white shirts. I may because it's easier to match with ties. But it's not a compulsion to do what everybody does. It's a question of, how do we view this? Do we view this as risky or not? There was one more question, and then I want to go further. Yeah. So my understanding is that at this point most of them have come out to say it's unacceptable. There will always be some who will be outliers because there will always be some for fill in the rest of the sentence. But my understanding actually is that most do. It took a long time, but most do prohibit it at this point. And the reason why had less to do with Shomer Psayim Hashem and more to do with the fact that you had many significant rabbinic figures who had smoked for decades and decades, combined with the fact that everybody knows the story of somebody who smoked a pack a day and died at the age of 97, you know, of something else entirely. So, you know, that helps people to convince themselves that this really isn't risky or that they can evade the odds. It's as much sociology as it is psak. So that's our first stage. That's our elective surgery stage. Let's now shift to talk about issues that are specifically in terms of cosmetic surgery. And again, I'm talking about elective cosmetic surgery, not something that's necessary to save somebody's life, not something that's necessary to repair a disfigurement from a burn. That's not what I'm talking about. So the literature that I've seen dates the popularity of plastic surgery to post-World War I, taking advantage of the advances that came with treating soldiers who have been disfigured in the war. Although the practice itself of plastic surgery is actually very, very old. We find a Tosfos, a comment on the Talmud from roughly 13th century, that speaks about the case of someone who was going to get married, had a physical blemish, and then had it repaired by a physician. So that's almost 1,000 years ago they're doing it. And if you look in the literature, you can find examples that are even earlier. So there are three factors that I want to explore here. The first one is the one that people are going to find funny, but nonetheless, it's Torah, and I need to go through the question. And that is the question of whether males are allowed to undergo these sorts of procedures, or is this considered a feminine activity? That will be question number one. I'll explain that more when we get to it. The second question will be, is there anything wrong, ethically wrong, with correcting God's handiwork? God made a person this way. Are you... Yeah, by what right do you now alter it? And then third, is beautification an appropriate pursuit? So those are the three questions that we need to deal with in terms of cosmetic surgery, and then for the last part we'll be looking at the permanent makeup question. But first, the question of whether this is considered a feminine activity. Where in the world did that question come from? Take a look at source number 9, please. Source number 9 is a biblical verse against cross-dressing. Lo yehi gever al isha, V'lo yobash gever simlat isha. A man's implement shall not be on a woman, and a man shall not wear a woman's garment. What's the concern in about cross-dressing? Why is it that the Torah is prohibiting that? Take a look at source number 10. Shelo yobash ish simlat isha v'yeshev ben hanashim v'yisha simlat ish v'teshev ben ha'anashim. The Talmud says the concern is that if the man wears a woman's dress, he gets to go hang out in the women's locker room. If the woman wears the man's garment, then she's going to go sit among the men, and various television sitcoms will be born. The concern is that in the event that you allow this, it can lead to illicit sexual relations. That's what the Talmud states there, which is an important point, because let's take this, as a practical question for a moment and ask, let's say you live in a society in which, and I don't think this is true here, but let's go with this for a second. Let's say you live in a society in which only women wear earrings. Okay? Or only men wear baseball caps. So is there a problem with a man wearing an earring? Is there a problem with a girl wearing a baseball cap? If your concern is they're going to appear like the opposite gender and be able to mix, I don't think the earring's what's going to do it. I don't think the baseball cap is what's going to do it. In other words, a single garment against an entire wardrobe that isn't deceptive would seem not to be a concern. You follow? So that's one potential consideration. The other potential consideration is mentioned by Maimonides in source number 11. In his Sefer HaMitzvot, where he lists all of the Torah's mitzvot and provides a brief paragraph about each one, he adds a concern. He says, know that this activity, meaning having women ornament themselves with men's ornaments and having men ornament themselves with women's ornaments, is sometimes done to awaken one's nature to illicit sexual behavior, as is known among those who stray. And sometimes it is practiced as part of idolatry, as is explained in texts on the subject. In other words, that you may have found an idolatrous ritual that involved adoption of the garb of the opposite gender. So that's a second concern that is brought. And the Talmud, when it discusses this concern, doesn't only apply it to wearing the garment of the opposite gender, but it also applies it to acts of grooming that are associated with the opposite gender, and specifically with men performing acts of grooming that socially were considered to be women's actions. Now, very important point, which we're going to come back to. It's determined by your society. I gave the earring example. When I was a kid growing up, this is in New York in the 70s and 80s, so we were indeed told by our teachers, no, earrings are what girls wear. If you go, maybe 10 years later, they couldn't have said that with a straight face. It simply wasn't true socially. For that matter, had they gone back to biblical times, they couldn't say it with a straight face. The biblical text is very clear that men were wearing rings, and not only in their ears. The piercings today have nothing on the piercings that were going on. So it is, it is socially determined in terms of what people are doing. And again, we're going to come back to that, but I wanted to stress that right now, because I'm about to tell you about a series of applications of this that are brought in the Talmud that would have to be revisited in each era. The Talmud mentions concern about men shaving their armpits, and saying that in evidently Talmudically that was something that women did, but that men did not. And if a man were to do that, that would be considered an act of feminine grooming. Plucking out the white hairs from among the black hairs, as the Talmud states, is another example. Scraping one's skin in order to beautify it. Actually brought that there in source number 12. You see it there that they mention that it would be considered inappropriate for a man to scrape that off for beauty. He could do it to mitigate pain if it's painful, but otherwise he wouldn't be allowed to do it. It comes up in terms of dyeing one's hair. Concern for grooming in ways that are normally women's ways, lest that lead to either the concern mentioned in source number 10 of inappropriate mixing, or the concern in number 11 that this was somehow associated with idolatrous practices. So, Let's say that's a consideration. Let's say we are now worried about a prohibition against engaging in a type of grooming that the other gender does. For a man to engage in a type of grooming that maybe is more common among women, would we then say, in fact, he's not allowed to? So let's say, for example, and here I hope it's not offensive for me to say, I'm just giving it as a case, and please don't shoot me. But let's say that within a certain society, you could demonstrate that a nose job was more likely to happen among women than it was among men. Let's pretend that that was true. I have no data on it. I haven't researched it because I don't want to know. But let's say that could be determined. Would we then say a man who wanted to have surgery on his nose would not be allowed to do so? Take a look at source number 12 and answer the question for me. Meaning? The man would not be allowed? Take a look at number 12 more carefully. 12, not 13. 13 is the answer. Shh, don't say anything about 13. What? What about psychological pain? Good. Source number 12 tells me that the man is allowed to scrape off this, whatever this is, dirt, scabs that are on his flesh in order to mitigate pain. So take a look at source number 13, in which Tosfot writing, and as I noted there, you know, Tosfot is across a series of generations. So call it 13th, 14th century. They say, "V'im ein lo tzar acher elashem isbayesh lelech bein b'nei adam," if he is in no other pain besides being embarrassed to walk among people, it is permitted. There is no greater pain than that. We rate the concern for psychological pain, for emotional pain, very high. And it's not considered to be problematic. This isn't considered to be something done for beauty. This is considered to be something done for one's health. And that's the major source that is quoted to justify this. If you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Menashe Klein, in his Mishnah Halachas, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach said the same. He writes, "Mevoar, it's clear that one who is in pain, embarrassed to be among people, is not subject to this prohibition of the man not wearing the woman's garment. Therefore, a man who has marks and is therefore embarrassed to be among people may remove them." That's the ruling that he gives, and this comes up in a variety of cases. One of the very popular examples of it is vitiligo. Right? In which, depending on the level of one's skin, normal skin pigment, but a person will have sections of the skin that will become depigmented, that will lose the pigment, and they'll appear blotchy. So if their skin is fair, it's not really so noticeable. Right? If you see for yourself here, you see I have this white eyebrow, white half eyebrow here, and a little bit of a blotch over there. It's because I have it. You won't notice it on my skin, but you can notice it if you know what to look for, or if you see the person has hair that loses the color. And if a person has a naturally darker skin, then it's really noticeable. And that is what he's talking about, what Rabbi Klein is talking about. He said the person is embarrassed to be among people. We're not going to tell him, well, you can't get that fixed because that's not a male type of grooming. The concern for his pain overrides it. That's number one. There are two other grounds for overriding it. The second ground for overriding it is where this becomes a standard practice for males. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch talks about this. I mentioned that one of the Talmudic cases that are brought about women's grooming is shaving the hair of one's armpits. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in fact, writes that this is considered to be a violation of rabbinic law for the man to shave his armpit hair, but then he continues to say, this is only where only women remove it, lest he practice feminine improvements. Where men also remove it, he's not punished for removing it. The statement is, it depends on what is considered normal, and then we come back to our question again, who is the standard for normal? So if you flip the page, take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Yehoshua Falk wrote the Prisha commentary to an early code of Jewish law called the Tur. He wrote, it appears that when we talk about who does this, it means non-Jews. It doesn't just mean Jews. You look around to see, in general, in society, is this something that only women do, or is it something that men and women do together? That it's both. And he says, since they do this, since they perform this action, they do it, and we learn from non-Jewish practice. One could also, sorry, I should have added the word say, one could also say, he is speaking of Jews, that where they all do it as one, we do not protest. In other words, the fundamental question you have to ask is, if you're telling me men aren't allowed to do this, because it's a women's type of a grooming, how is it ever going to change to become something that men do also? The first person to do it is going to get zapped for having done it. So how do you end up with a society in which, if you're only using Jews as your barometer, how do you end up with a society in which this becomes normal? So either your answer is we're gauging by society as a whole, and not just Jews. Your other answer is if this is en masse, just everybody suddenly starts engaging in this behavior. I'm not really clear what that looks like. In practice, what is that? And I think he's not necessarily so sure either, which is why he gave you his first answer first, which is to say we're gauging by Jewish and non-Jewish society to determine whether this is a masculine activity or whether this is something that that is a feminine activity. Either way, what emerges is another reason to permit, which is where it becomes standard practice for both genders. The third possibility is where there is a practical benefit. I did not bring it here on the sheet, but the Torah Lishma, which is by the Ben Yishchai Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, notes that, let's say, he has. Let's pretend you live in a society in which women would remove the hair of their armpits, but men would not remove it. However, the hair becomes thick and tangled and sweaty, and it's actually bothersome. So there's a practical thing to be gained by removing it. And he says, yes, that will be justification as well. So in terms of this subtopic, in terms of cosmetic surgery, the question of, is it inappropriate for a male if something is a female activity? So the answer is, yes, there is a Talmudic restriction, which is from the biblical text, against engaging in grooming that is of the other gender, whether it's because of a concern for mixing that can lead to illicit sexual relations, whether it's a concern about some kind of idolatrous practice, there is such a prohibition. However, it doesn't apply if a person does this because they are ashamed of their appearance and they can't go out in public. It doesn't apply if it's become standard practice for males. And it doesn't apply if there is a practical benefit involved. Are we clear on that? I recognize the whole idea of behavior in grooming that is male-specific or female-specific is probably something that's worthy of its own class and its own discussion. It won't be right now, because we have a lot else to see, but yes, this is a can of worms that we have opened. Jeffrey.
Does the discussion about people being permitted to consider altering their appearance because they're ashamed of their appearance, taking into account the distorted body image?
Yes.
Low self-esteem?
Yes. No, very...
In these classical texts, do they well?
Yes. Right, no, and the answer is very much yes. Whether it would have been diagnosed as a distorted body image until modern times, is not so much the point. But the idea that if a person is feels, whether it doesn't matter what everybody else feels, everybody else says, then you look fine. But if their feeling is I can't go out in public, then they'll have grounds to invoke what Tosfos says here and say they're able to change it.
Actually thinking, for example, it doesn't necessarily involve surgery, but
yeah.
In the case of anorexia,
right,
where a person does not perceive that they look fine, they're convinced that they do not, and they go to extreme measures to alter their appearance to conform with what in
their... Oh, you're saying, in other words, the surgery is because they're in this unhealthy place. I see. So at that point, you need to get the psychologist very heavily involved in figuring out what's best for this person. In other words, we are concerned with a life or death situation, in terms of what you're describing, and you need to be guided by the people who are the experts on it. If they say it's bad to indulge this, then it's bad to indulge this, regardless of what justifications may be offered. So that's part one. Part two, the question of correcting God's work. There's a fascinating story that appears in the Talmud in Tanit. I only brought you one line from it, in source number 17, about a sage, Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, who was... He left the Beit Midrash where he had been studying. He was feeling really good about the learning that he had been doing. And he encounters somebody out on the road. And take a look at what happens. Amarlo, he says to this person he encounters out on the road, Reka, empty one, how ugly is this man? Are all the people in your city as ugly as you? Yeah, wow. There's a problem here. There are numerous problems with this story. This is the second can of worms, but that's the way it goes. That's what he says to him, to which the man replies with, I think, the best possible reply. Amarlo, Eini Yodea. He says, I don't know. Go tell the craftsman who made me how ugly is this implement you made. You got a problem with the way I look? Go take it up with God. That's his rejoinder, and at that point, as the story plays out, the rabbi who said this, he realizes instantly just how big a mistake he's made, and he travels after him. This fellow is riding on a donkey. He walks after him, pleading with him to forgive him. He refuses to forgive him. They get back to his city. It's a whole story that continues from this one line. I bring it here only because the person's rejoinder is, God made me this way. Beauty fundamentally is something for which we say, look, this, you look this way because of God's will. Now, the truth is, the Talmud has a passage in Masechet Nidah where it talks about the contributions of different parents to the appearance of the child. And there's a role that today we recognize in terms of genetics, in terms of the way someone is going to look and the input that the parents have in what the person is going to look like. But the fundamental question is this somehow an inappropriate form of intervention? What would you say? Is this offensive to God if I say I want to change the way I look? Sorry?
It can't be.
Can't be. Why not?
It's a question of to what degree. I put on clothes every morning. It changes the way I look.
Right. We do things all the time that change the way we look, right? Whether it's in terms of clothing, or in terms of dieting, or in terms of exercise, or in terms of any number of things. I was going to say someone goes to get a tan, but that comes into the health things also, so scratch that. But people do things in order to change the way they look. They get a haircut. There are all sorts of things that we do to change our appearance, and we're not terribly concerned that somehow this is an act of rebellion against God. If you take a look at source number 18, I brought you one example of many, many sources that could be brought on the topic. Comes from the Maharal of Prague, the famous one who did not make a golem, but nonetheless, can't seem to escape it. And he writes, just as nature operates at divine decree, and nature functioned during the 6 days of creation as is appropriate for nature, the same applies to the actions of a person with his brain, which is above nature, and with his deeds, which are not of nature. In other words, what he says is, that is the nature of things. That human beings have a brain, and human beings have tools, and we have the ability to alter the way we look. This gets quoted frequently in the discussion about GMO foods and the issue of manipulating agriculture. He says, we're given these tools, and not only that, but many authorities and many rabbis write about the fact that we are encouraged to be creative. Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik spoke at length about this topic, saying that when the Torah says "V'alachta bidrachav," that we're supposed to walk in God's ways, that means that we are supposed to be creators, because the very first thing we know about God in the Torah is that God creates. So, yes, we are going to create, we are going to adjust, and that's not considered to be an act of rebellion against God. So that's our second of the three considerations. The third is whether beautification is an appropriate pursuit. Is this something that a nice Jewish boy, nice Jewish girl should consider a value for themselves? Are we perhaps placing emphasis on the wrong thing by looking at beauty? In the case that Rabbi Feinstein dealt with earlier, right, where the girl says, I need to adjust the way my nose looks because that's the reason why I'm not finding a mate. So, you know, should somebody maybe say to her, maybe not to her, I'm not sure exactly how to deal with the situation. I'm not counseling this situation. But should someone be looking at the value system by which the males are operating? Should somebody be looking at the overall messages we're sending in society that will say to somebody, if you just change the way your nose looks, then you'll be able to find your one true love? How should we feel about having a system in which people pursue beauty as a means of feeling better about themselves? Big question. What do you say? Yes. The argument is one person cannot change the system, but what about if we're looking at it from the view of the rabbi who's giving advice, whose word is then going to affect all the people that they are able to advise? So maybe that person, that rabbi, is responsible to say, what I say can in fact change the system. If only in that area, if only in that population, maybe they can change things. Yeah. Yes, the question is, and then what? What happens after they get the nose job and it didn't change the world?
Now they. He's not speaking to the man. He's speaking to the women.
Yeah. Yeah, he needs a mind job after that. Correct. So, the truth of the matter is. The truth of the matter is that the gut reaction is to say, well, beauty is a shallow concern, right? You have the verse in Proverbs in Mishlei, Sheker Achein Vehevel Hayofi, beauty is false. And that's all well and good. At the same time, the desire for beauty is given standing within Jewish law. For example, if a woman just got married and then, Rachmana Lislan, she ends up sitting Shiva, so she's able to wear makeup in order that she shouldn't have to go out without, not go out, she's not going out, she's in Shiva, but in order that she shouldn't feel uncomfortable and worried about her appearance at this early stage in her marriage. There is a validation of the concern for how I look. And this is at a time when, she's in Shiva, she really shouldn't have to be worried about this. But there's a recognition that this is a substantive concern for people. It comes up in other contexts as well. We have great concern for human dignity. And human dignity includes that which people perceive about themselves. I brought it in source number 19. I won't go through the text inside in the interests of time. But we are taught that kavod habriyot, human dignity, is so great that it overrides the Torah's rabbinic prohibitions. Even though rabbinic prohibitions stem from a biblical law that says, follow the words of the sages, nonetheless, that is overridden in the interests of protecting people's dignity. And so the argument could be made, if this is what someone sees as the obstacle to their dignity, then they should go ahead and change it. Yeah, Jeffrey. Yeah.
There's the example of this tricolored earring or something for France that was permitted to be worn, even though probably just a first and probably
There are numerous cases within Jewish law in which we say that that beauty ends up being a significant factor. The concern for people being able to feel attractive matters a great deal. Yes. Yeah. 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 Yes. And it's evidence that there is such a thing as an acceptable surgery for the sake of beautification. Yes. Why? So in other words, we've answered the question by the fact that the Torah has cases of people wearing earrings. Right, piercing in order to wear, and it's not just an earring, it's a nose ring also. So does that already answer the question of whether it's an appropriate pursuit? It's definitely an interesting point. Maybe we should just take that and we could shut things down. It's a valid point. I want to just show you source number 20. Rabbi Leo Bakshidoron in Israel notes that not every claim of human dignity carries equal weight. He says, imagine the case in which I find an object that somebody else lost, and I know who lost it, so I have a mitzvah of returning the lost object. But I say, it's beneath my dignity for me to bend down and pick that up and go bring it to the person. It was in the gutter, it's dirty, it's whatever it is. He says, the honor of an individual who decides to honor himself and be arrogant, refusing to carry a sack or a box to return it, is based on personal calculations, and he can't thereby exempt himself or override a rabbinic prohibition. Just the opposite, he should conquer his character and not cancel the mitzvah. Meaning, a person has to ask themselves, how serious is this? When I say, I need this for my dignity, where is this coming from? And am I perhaps letting, you know, sort of getting away, running away with my concern for my dignity, beyond what should be the norm? And that's a difficult question. It's very case-specific. I don't think that you can give across-the-board rules to address it. But what we now have are the following. Number one, we said that regarding elective surgery in general, you have to ask, is this a risk that is normally considered to be acceptable? And, per Ellen's point, one that isn't clearly harmful. Number two, we said, wounding oneself or allowing oneself to be wounded is not allowed. However, if it's a healing act, it's going to be okay. So the question will be, is this beautification an act of healing? Which brings us to the cosmetic surgery points. For men, number one, the special concern of whether it's appropriate, justified if one is greatly ashamed of his appearance, or if it's become a standard practice for males, or if there's a practical benefit to it. The issue of correcting God's work, we said, is not a concern. And the issue of beautification, we recognize that people are allowed to pursue that which will bring them greater dignity, but they should be careful not to let themselves run away with it. That brings me to the last issue. And the last issue is the permanent makeup discussion. If anybody needs to leave, just make sure that you did sign in. There are sheets up here, but I hope there are also sheets in the back. But if you want to be able to get follow-up afterwards on topics, please make sure that you sign in. The last topic is permanent makeup, also known as micropigmentation. And I want to note at the outset of it that my basis for this came largely from an excellent article written by Rabbi J. David Bleich in the journal Tradition. You can find it in the link that's at source number 21. Afterwards, when I email out the follow-up, I'll also email out a digital copy of the source sheets, so you'll be able to just click on that link instead of having to retype the link. I'm okay, thank you. So, what we're talking about now is micropigmentation of the skin, and it's something that is cosmetic rather than medical. What's the concern in micropigmentation? Why might it not be allowed? Sorry? Tattooing. Right, the concern would be the concern for a tattoo. Now, what's actually done, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand the way that permanent makeup or micropigmentation works, is that a needle is used to deliver pigment into the lower layer of the skin. It is not actually permanent. The estimates I've seen for how long it lasts tend to be about 3 or 4 years. Roughly correct? Okay. Sorry?
Even less.
Even less. Okay. Yes.
The concern about tattoos, is that because, does that relate back to the idea you don't want something on your body that you might worship or something like that? Is that the idea?
Good question. We're going to have to address that. What we do know is the Torah has a specific biblical verse that prohibits what's called in Hebrew, ketovet ka'aka, which is understood to refer to a tattoo. We're going to have to translate those words in a few minutes. But the question is this a tattoo? You are coloring the skin in a way that will last multiple years. So there are five potential reasons for leniency when you're dealing with this so-called permanent makeup. The first reason for leniency is that it's not permanent. The prohibition against the tattoo is usually phrased as a prohibition against a permanent mark. If you take a look at source number 22. Source number 22, a Mishnah, the building block of the Talmud, it states that it's dealing with a list of prohibitions, and one of them is one who writes ketovet ka'aka. So one who writes but doesn't do what's called ka'aka, which in the case of what they're referring to here, it sounds like they're saying ka'aka is the ink. That's what, I'm sorry, is the engraving. So one who writes, meaning you make the ink marks but you don't engrave, or one who does the engraving but doesn't do any coloring, is not liable until he writes and does ka'aka with ink or kechol or anything which makes a mark. I had a professor of Arabic who explained to me, interestingly, what's the word in Hebrew for blue?
Kechol.
And sound like a word that you know in English? Alcohol. Because their blue dye was an alcohol-based dye. Alcohol from Arabic, al-kukhla, is alcohol. Very interesting. Anyway, the kahol here is a blue dye. So what it's saying here is that you're not liable for a tattoo unless you do this, make this engraving with ink, something that makes a mark. So on that Mishnah, Rashi makes the comment that you have in 23. Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. He says, regarding the person who tattoos, he first writes on his skin with an ink, and then engraves his skin with a needle or blade, and the dye enters between the skin and the flesh and remains visible forever. Ka'aka is, and he quotes an old French word, then he says, one may not write anything on his flesh in this manner, for the text has decreed it. The key for us right now is that source number 23, Rashi, uses the term in Hebrew, le'olam. In the English, it is forever. So the argument goes that you don't have to worry with permanent makeup because it's not permanent, because it's not there forever. Now, the truth is that other sources do say that, no, it just is a long time. It doesn't have to be forever in order for it to be prohibited. And then even if it's not prohibited biblically, it'll still be prohibited rabbinically. But that's one reason for leniency, is that this permanent makeup isn't really permanent. The second reason for leniency goes back to the wording in source number 23. Rashi presented the order as, first, writing on your skin, and then engraving the skin after that. Engraving a skin with a needle or a blade. Pigment first, and then cutting. Take a look, please, at source number 24, where Maimonides gives you his formulation. It's the opposite. He says, the ka'aka writing mentioned in the Torah is that one cuts his flesh and fills the cut with ink or other marking dyes. In other words, Maimonides describes tattooing as cutting first and using ink second. So the question is, does the order actually matter? Is the order significant? If the order is significant, then we're in good shape. Because when you do micropigmentation, which order are you doing? Neither. It's simultaneous. Right? You're putting the needle under the skin to make the mark. It's not cutting first and then making and then the ink, and it's not ink first and then cutting. They're actually considered potentially simultaneous. Yes? You mean in terms of the way tattooing is done today? Is that true? I have to admit, I don't know how tattooing is done today. Is that true, though?
Yes.
That's the way tattoos are done today? Okay. Then yes, potentially you could apply this argument to that case as well. It would apply anywhere in which you've eliminated the order. Rabbi Bleich points out something interesting. He says that the reason, perhaps, why Rashi versus Rambam have opposite ways for the order is that it depends on how you explain the word ketovet versus how you explain the word ka'aka. If you explain that ketovet means writing and ka'aka means the and ka'aka means the engraving of it, then it's first ketovet, first the mark, and then the engraving. Whereas if you say that ketovet is the engraving and ka'aka refers to the ink, then it's cutting first and then ink. But either way, one way to look at it is to suggest that the order matters. However, not everybody agrees that the order matters. Take a look at source number 25. That's the Shulchan Aruch. The Code of Jewish Law says that the tattoo is where one cuts his flesh and fills the cut with ink or other marking dyes, implying it's cutting first and then marking it with ink. But in 26, Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, in one of the key commentaries to the Code of Jewish Law, says the same applies if he writes with dye first and then cuts the place with a dye. It says the order doesn't matter. So, if you believe the order matters, then you can make the argument that the permanent makeup would not qualify for the biblical prohibition. It might be rabbinically prohibited still, but it wouldn't qualify for the biblical prohibition. So that's a second argument to be lenient. The third argument to be lenient goes back to what Maimonides said in source number 24, what the Rambam wrote, the second half of his text. After he describes the act, he says, this, the tattooing, was the practice of idolaters. And it goes back to your question about why they would tattoo. This was the practice of idolaters, marking themselves for idolatry, as if to declare that he is a slave, sold to it, marked for its service. Maimonides says the original tattooing that was prohibited was tattooing that was done for the sake of commitment to idolatry. And that's brought in the Sefer HaChinuch. If you take a look at source number 27, Sefer HaChinuch is a book that goes through all of the Torah's mitzvot and tries to provide an explanation, a little explanation for each. And he uses a key word. He says regarding tattooing, if one is kotev afilu ot achat, if one writes even one letter, that suggests that the tattoo that is biblically prohibited is a letter, writing. If you engage in permanent makeup, if you engage in this micropigmentation, there's no cognitive message being conveyed, not by words and not by pictures. And so the argument could be made to that it won't be biblically prohibited on those terms. Notice that I keep saying that these are reasons to say it's not biblically prohibited. There could still be rabbinic prohibitions. I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but I want to go through the list of five first. So we've seen three reasons so far. The not being permanent. It's not a sequence of two separate actions of cutting and inking. It's one action. And the fact that there's no message conveyed in it. The fourth reason for leniency would be that it has a practical function. What you're talking about is an act that's done not just for the sake of something that could be understood as idolatrous or in any way, but it's simply something done because they want to look a certain way. If you take a look at source number 28, they dealt with a therapy that involved ash. If somebody had a wound, they would put ash from a kiln on the wound. Now, that ash could potentially dye the wound. And there's a wound. There's a mark there on the skin, and now you're putting something that dyes it into it. But they're doing it therapeutically. And so the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 28, says, yeah, that's okay. You're allowed to put the ash from the fire onto the wound. Because fundamentally, the wound demonstrates that this is not done for idolatry, it's done for healing purposes. I brought it for you in source number 29, from Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, from the Shach. So the idea is, if you're doing it for a therapeutic purpose, then it won't come under the prohibition against tattooing. And the argument would be that micropigmentation, permanent makeup, is clearly not something done for idolatry. It's something done to change one's appearance in order to have eyeliner or whatever it is that they're trying to have. So that's the fourth grounds. The fifth and last point is that perhaps if the micropigmentation is meant to restore natural color, not to change something, but to restore natural color. The argument goes that maybe that wouldn't fit within the prohibition either. It's giving natural color. It's not something that makes a mark that's meant for people to see it. So that's the fifth ground. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that one because it's a little bit weaker than the other 4 points. So, putting all this together, okay, in terms of the micropigmentation, in terms of permanent makeup, we have different grounds which can reduce it from a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. Does that then mean it's okay? I'm hearing no's, but there's a big yes. There's a big potential yes. The last source on your sheet, source number 30, Rabbi J. David Blythe commenting on a comment by the Chatam Sofer on this issue of tattooing. I'm going to explain it outside of what he says here, but you can see his own text here. What he explains is this. There are two ways you can look at a rabbinic prohibition. One way you can look at a rabbinic prohibition is to say, the Torah says, don't make words on your skin. If it's not a word, the rabbis prohibited it anyway. Or, the Torah says not to do two acts in sequence, cutting and inking. However, the rabbi said, even if it's one act, it's still prohibited. If you look at it that way, then all of these answers don't help. And you're right, it's a rabbinic prohibition regardless. However, the other way to look at it is cumulatively. Meaning, what the rabbi, and this is what Rabbi Bleich is arguing for in source number 30, what the rabbi's prohibited is an act of tattooing that looks like tattooing in all the biblical ways, except that it's a single action. Or, an act that looks like tattooing in all the biblical ways, except that it doesn't involve words. But once it deviates from the biblically prohibited act on multiple grounds, and in this case, it deviates from the biblical prohibition on four different grounds, because it's not a single, because it's not two different acts, it's not truly permanent, it doesn't involve writing, and it's clearly something that's not idolatrous, it's something that's done for aesthetic reasons. Once you can combine all four of those, potentially it's so far from the original biblical act that no, that's not what the rabbinic prohibitions were meant to prohibit. Is that clear? You understand the logic? So I went through about 10 different responsa on this topic to see where the rabbis fall out. You want to guess? Everywhere. Everywhere is the right answer. I found the following authorities who prohibit. Rav Nathan Gishtetner, the Laharos Nasan, Rabbi Shmuel Wasner, the Shevet Alevi, the Kol Eretz Chemda in Israel, Chabad Lubavitch, Rav Shmuel Eliyahu. They all said, no, not able to do it. On the permissive side, Rav Nevinsal, Rav Avadya Yosef, Rav Yaakov Ariel, all came out saying they believe it's permitted. And then you had a middle school which said, better not to do it, but there is room for leniency because of what we've said if a person has a particular need, such as they have something that actually is disfigured or doesn't look in a way that they feel is normal and they're embarrassed and so forth, then they're willing to say that there are those who can who will permit. So Rav Asher Weiss, the Beit Horah, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, are all cited as acknowledging that there may be room to permit in a case of need. Rabbi Bleich also notes on a separate note that if the technician is not Jewish, that may also help eliminate some of the concerns that are involved. It's a longer discussion I didn't want to go into. But what I want to draw from this, I said in the very beginning, and I reiterate now, nothing that I say here should be taken as, Torchiner said, go out and do, or don't do, for that matter. I believe very strongly that you go to your rabbi for practical guidance in matters of halacha. But hopefully what emerges from this is an understanding that nothing is simple, but that we have an approach for dealing with the question of elective surgery and the question of risk as well as the question for wounding. We have an approach for dealing with cosmetic surgery and the concern for whether this is an appropriate pursuit of beauty, whether for males or whether for people in general. And in terms of permanent makeup, there is something to be discussed in terms of how, to what extent this resembles the biblical prohibition against tattooing and to what extent rabbinic prohibitions might be, might or might not be involved. Thank you very much. The...